what's happened here is we've basically created a biochemical scenario in our bodies where we've raised our blood sugar. Now we want to sequester that, and we've put the body into storage mode, but we didn't eat a single thing. We were just under blue light or on the phone for 3 hours.
Okay, welcome back to the Regenerative Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Max Culhane. Today, we have a very, very interesting episode, and that is with Dr. Sarah Pugh. Now, Sarah is a postdoctoral PhD researcher who had a long career in research in a range of topics, including genetics and molecular biology, who subsequently trained in and studied hypnosis, functional neurology, Pilates, and a whole bunch of very interesting complementary medical fields. Her depth of knowledge is astounding. And in this conversation, we cover a whole bunch of really, really interesting topics. What we talked about that I think is going to be particularly interesting is how our light environment and how our circadian environment influences and causes metabolic disease and diabetes. And we talk a lot about how the solar environment that we're exposed to is influencing our insulin sensitivity, or therefore our ability to tolerate things like dietary carbohydrates and not get metabolically sick. So this is a very, very interesting episode, and one I think for people who are particularly trying to reverse metabolic disease, one that they should listen to. So thank you for watching, and onto the podcast. So Sarah, thank you for coming onto the podcast.
Yes, lovely to meet you, Max. I've watched a lot of your podcasts, and I'm a big fan of yours.
Thanks, Sarah. And look, I've been astounded by the depth of your knowledge when I've listened to your recent appearances on a whole bunch of shows. And I'd like to get an idea about how you started in this game, and then what led you down the path to kind of viewing health so holistically as you do now.
Yes, that's a good point, because I suppose I've always been interested in health and supplements. I think I bought my first supplement when I was 16, and what was around then was just sort of fitness and bodybuilding magazines. There wasn't the plethora, and there was obviously no internet. And then I was really interested in martial arts and different ways of eating, even when I was at school. Then I studied biochemistry and genetics. I did my PhD, and that involved biophysics, but I didn't really understand how light affected the body until sort of 20 years later. And then I think you just end up going on a journey that when I left science, because I was uncomfortable working on statins and cholesterol, but I didn't have the knowledge at the time I do now to realize how bad it was. I just knew I was doing something I shouldn't be. And then the environment of being a scientist can be unpleasant as well. Not the people, it's just it's basically being in a lab under blue light all day, and it's stressful, and you're hunched over a microscope or a bench. So that's what led me into Pilates, because I needed to improve my posture and get rid of my backache. And then as soon as you enter the holistic world, that's when you discover everything from Reiki to acupuncture to Chinese medicine to different ways of eating that are sort of more organized. And then things just sort of progressed into training in medical ketogenic diets with Beth Zupek-Kania, and then exploring how to use fasting with that. And I did actually know about quantum biology quite a long time ago, because I follow Dave Asprey, and I think he was the pioneer of, you know, these are still the original true darks, these are like really old, my glasses. So I knew about, I should be blocking blue light in the evening, and I didn't really take it particularly seriously until I ended up, you know, as I got older, I had a few problems and I couldn't resolve them. And that's when I really got into Dr. Jack Cruise's work. It was sort of in lockdown particularly, but that's when a lot of people encountered problems. And then I made the link of you're getting worse because you're just inside running an internet business under blue light. And then once you discover Jack Cruise, I think it's like a whole other planet, basically. And then I started implementing quantum biology with my clients, and I was able to get into some of the people. I just had no idea why things weren't working. And also I used to turn away clients because I think, oh, I've got no idea where I could possibly begin with this. And now I feel very confident that I go always do the circadian first, and then I kind of layer everything else on top. That's where I'm at right now. I'm actually doing some training with Dr. Tom Cowan at the moment, who's another person who's got a very interesting way of approaching the body and disease. And he's written a book on the heart and how it's not a pump. And he's very interested in water and structured water as well. So I'm forever learning, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I did a year of basic science research at a lab as well, and I can agree with you that it's an absolutely horrific environment to be spending a lot of time under such harsh and stark light. There is a little bit of painful work in that you're often doing very interesting work, but it's mm-hmm. definitely coming at the expense of health. Although I didn't want to make this topic of our talk, I'd like to get your brief opinion on statin medications and perhaps what was the reasons why you particularly were unhappy about continuing to research in them.
Well, first of all, from a very simplistic point of view, if our body makes something, it must be really important. And also, I think it was the way in which some of the grants were written, that they'd literally write you a project and it almost said, this is our hypothesis, please produce some data here, and then you can have a publication. So it was almost laid out that you had to, the project wasn't as free as you thought it was. And it was basically my project was to look at how statins affected beta-2 adrenergic receptors in the heart. And it was just, people were desperate for anything positive they could say about statins at that given time, because that was the sort of 2007, 2008 era when they were just racking up all of the, let's find as many positive things that statins can do and we'll just push that. And that's what really made me think, hang on a minute, I'm not okay with this really, because it is a drug. And yes, I do understand it at the molecular level in Cavioli, but I don't really understand what this is going to do to people with their cholesterol all over their body. Because I started to look into depression then and realized, well, there's an implication. A quarter of our brain is cholesterol. So if depleting cholesterol there, that's going to have implications. I did know enough about sex hormones by then, even though that wasn't something I studied in biochemistry, to know that if you don't have adequate cholesterol, you're going to have trouble with things like pregnenolone, your testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. So that got me slightly, well, hang on a minute, that's another fundamental pathway that's been interfered with the statins. And then after that, I just got really, I kind of really fell in love with cholesterol as a molecule, and it does just so much more again, because I love it from a quantum perspective, because it's one of these things we'd call a time crystal. And I just say in simple language, it's a molecule that can is very important for how we tell the time, whether it's seasonal or during the day. And every day I learn something interesting, that even LDL, which really annoys me, people try and say good and bad cholesterol. Well, LDL is just a lipoprotein that happens to have cholesterol in it, along with a lot of other things. And then numerous benefits are popping up of the benefits of LDL, from immunity to mood, and all sorts. So I think that was the kind of kicker for me, that even when I wasn't an expert in quantum biology, and I mean, I know so much more about cholesterol, back then alarm bells were ringing, just the fact the quarter of your brain. And then that was sort of what then made me question everything. I mean, I already knew the saturated fat data was incorrect. I knew about Ansel Keys back then. And then gradually, bit by bit, more, I discover a new lie every day, whether it's sun cream or sunglasses or sun cream. I could go on for ages about it. Oh, drink, you know, as much water as possible until you burst. There's all sorts of things that when you follow the money, you think, well, hang on a minute, I don't think I should be doing this. And I think that's another fundamental thing to do with research, would be follow the money.
Definitely. It's a very reliable heuristic. And when we follow the money, we pretty quickly find out where the incentives are lying and then what health practice or else is being pushed. On a broad level, and again, we'll talk about statins maybe another time, but I'm humble in terms of this idea of not knowing exactly what's happening, and the approach of blocking HMG-CoA reductase, which is the enzyme that statin medications block, it has so many second, third, fourth order effects that we're not aware of, and it's in my mind quite arrogant epistemologically to simply block that one pathway in a very reductionist way, and then assume that or hope that the total net benefit is positive. Obviously, this isn't medical advice, but that is something that I'd say about statin medications too. But let's talk about light, and let's talk about circadian biology and quantum health. And what you just said earlier in our conversation is that the first thing you address when you deal with a patient or a client that you're trying to help from a health point of view is that you address their light environment and their circadian biology. And I noticed that you didn't say that you recommend a certain diet or you advise on certain supplements. So talk us about this hierarchy of approach and why you have developed that approach.
Okay, well, the food thing, I do think it's really important to do a ketogenic diet or of sorts. I mean, there are probably 1,000 different variations, and I'll come back to that. I think it's because it's easy and it's free for people. So when it comes to changing their light environment, first of all, anything to do with food, and you'll know yourself being a medical doctor, people are very touchy and they get offended. So it's a way to build rapport with somebody without offending them, especially if someone's got a weight problem. So I don't even mention the food or anything to start with, because even if somebody doesn't want to get up in the morning and see the sunset yet, they can still buy blue blockers, they can still put iris on all of their devices, they'll buy a screen, or they can go and stand in their garden for half an hour or 10 minutes before going to bed, and that's going to help with the evening routine and the sleeping. And also, I know full well that if people won't get up and see the sunrise yet, that there's always the UVA rise they can see. And usually with those two things, somebody's going to feel better. Either they'll sleep better or they'll just be in a better mood. So straight away, there's been two easy wins for me. And now they're much more on board. Okay, well, this, you know, I like this. That was easy. What can I do next? And then it allows me to start to talk to them. When it comes to food, I tend to talk about how much deuterium there is in the food rather than macros, because I don't like telling people what they've heard a million times. I like to come round and bring it in a different way. And that's, again, a sort of partly my hypnosis or hypnotist background, to take people by surprise. And if I start talking about deuterium food and we're going to pick things from the red, we're not going to eat things in the red box because they've got lots of deuterium, but you can have things in the orange and the green, and we're just going to focus on that. And then people get kind of, well, what about calories and what about fat and protein? It's like, no, just eat the food in this box. It's very simple. And I found that approach can be really helpful as well, because I'm not treading on sort of people's sensitivities about their body or blaming them or telling them their diabetes is their fault or whatever. And then especially diabetes, I think something you're interested in as well, and it's so prevalent. I definitely bring up the blue light very early with people who've got diabetes, because I have had people, it is just the blue light. I've checked everything, their diet, their way of eating. I find out where they work, and it explains the high triglycerides and the HbA1c almost being borderline, yet everything else, they are doing it really well. And they take on board that as well, because it's very easy to change your light bulbs. It's diabetes versus some light bulbs. And the other thing I really like about a different approach is brown adipose tissue, which you can make more of doing cold thermogenesis, is biology's natural defense mechanism against diabetes. And I do have some people who are very willing or actually like being outside. They've never thought, oh, swimming in the sea or in my lake, you know, I didn't know. I would have gone in it a lot more if I'd have known. So I kind of approach these things that I come across a lot from a slightly different way. And then again, it's piquing people's curiosity. It's really important for them to, in the beginning, think, oh, this is easy, I'm going to get a good win. But sometimes you can make a huge needle move, because most people do know they shouldn't be eating certain things, and they know they should be exercising. They have absolutely no idea about light, and they can, if you know, in your own house, you can control the light a lot. I mean, yes, if you've got a husband or a wife that thinks this is all nonsense, it can be problematic. But on the whole, people want their spouse or their family or whoever to get better.
Yeah, and you've mentioned quite a lot there, Sarah, and I really love that framing of brown fat or brown adipose tissue as your natural defense against diabetes, because for those who aren't aware, it's a special type of fat that creates heat. So if you promote the development of brown fat by deliberate cold exposure, then it's it's an amazing way to prevent or reverse and prevent against the development of metabolic dysfunction. Maybe you could talk about deuterium, and I like to get every guest on who talks about circadian health and quantum health to really explain this concept of deuterium in their own way, because it is a very, very radical and different way of viewing health. I mean, no one else is really conceiving about deuterium or the biological effect of deuterium outside kind of this space. And I think it's very important, but it can also be difficult to conceptualize. So how do you think about deuterium and tell us about why that's how it relates to food?
Okay, so first of all, deuterium is an isotope or a variation of hydrogen. And because it's, without getting too technical, it's got a neutron in its nucleus, not just a proton and an electron. And in terms of, we all went and looked, so we've all seen the periodic table, whether we liked it or not at school, and hydrogen's number one, and it's actually the same group as other metals. If you look down, with sodium and potassium. So technically, deuterium is the king of the heavy metals, if you want to look at it like that. And in terms of health, most people, whether they know what mercury and cadmium are or not, they know that heavy metals are something that's not very nice. However, with deuterium and heavy metals, they're only a problem when they accumulate, because I'm not going to go into heavy metals, that's a whole other world. But with deuterium, because hydrogen and carbon are so much part of us, we're obviously going to be made of hydrogen, and we're going to have some deuterium as well. So even though deuterium is a heavy metal, luckily it only exists at something like 150 parts per million. So that would be, if you had a litre of water, it would be 2 drops of it. But because of the way the body works, even a few deuteriums that have built up over time start to become a problem. So first of all, deuterium isn't evil, because we need it to grow. So babies and flies and E. coli love deuterium because it makes them grow very quickly. It's just after the age of, say, 18 or 19 as a human, we don't need to grow anymore. And that's when the deuterium can turn nasty on us. So how does it turn nasty? So first of all, inside the mitochondria, it relies on a proton pump. So that's just hydrogens going down the ATPase to make ATP. If you try and put a deuterium down, because like I said, it's like a big hydrogen, it's like an adult sliding down a kid's toy or playing on the kid's tricycle, it's going to break the ATP, it's going to break your motor in your mitochondria. And when we start breaking mitochondria, then we're going to start to create inflammation or chaos. And that's, as we know, a recipe for disease. The other problem with deuterium is it's not quite the same in terms of its sort of magnetic or spin or dipole. So wherever there's a hydrogen in the body, there are going to be the possibility of deuterium. So, for example, something that people are familiar with, if you end up with deuterium in your cholesterol, when your body wants to turn the cholesterol into testosterone or estrogen or progesterone, the cholesterol doesn't look the same when there's a deuterium in a particular position. So straight away now you've created a hormone problem because there was deuterium in the cholesterol, and the enzyme that wants to change the cholesterol doesn't recognize it. Or in a more sort of physical term, it can just slow down the rates of reaction. But also generally because deuterium is bigger than hydrogen, when we look more into, just keep it simple, the mass equivalence, the E equals MC squared, we're just going to say that in our water network and other networks where we rely on hydrogen, the deuterium's bigger, so it provides less energy. And that propagates in terms of sort of simple language. If you haven't got enough energy in your body, you can't detox. You can't relax. You need to have energy in order to calm yourself down. And also, you can't run your immune system properly. So basically, I just, in simple terms, it's pretending if I was talking to a client, I'll just say it's this thing that's going to slow you down. And then for, say, somebody who was like a doctor or a scientist, I would go more scientific into it and say, well, actually, there's a significant amount of research in this. And somebody like Dr. Laszlo Boros is a very well-known researcher in this area. And I'd explain it in a sort of more biophysical way, but I'll always bring it back to the mitochondria, because even if people don't want to accept that they might have got deuterium in their thyroid hormones, or it likes to collect in organs as well, that nobody can argue with the fact that trying to push a deuterium through a mitochondria is a terrible idea. And the mitochondria will protect themselves as much as possible using the TCA or the citric acid cycle or Krebs cycle to keep the deuterium out. And again, just to emphasize, it's not evil. When we are quite good at depleting deuterium, assuming we haven't accumulated too much and we are fundamentally healthy and we're eating a diet that doesn't contain a lot of deuterium, so we poo it out. That's why flies love poo, because it's full of deuterium and they want to grow quickly. So they like it. Our gut microbiome likes deuterium because bacteria have a really quick life cycle. So again, back to gut health and quantum biology, if the gut microbiome's happy and you haven't tormented it with too much antibiotics or other things, it can deplete deuterium or get rid of it for you. Sweating is going to get it out. So again, exercise. Some people know, well, I know I should exercise and get sweaty, but I don't know why. That'll help get the deuterium out. And then again, cold therapy helps to deplete deuterium as well. So there are lots of natural inbuilt mechanisms that Mother Nature's provided for us to get rid of deuterium. It's just some people, nobody ever told them, or they didn't know, or they would say to me, well, I would have gone in a sauna if I'd have known, or I wouldn't have eaten that if I'd have known. So that's sort of one angle of the deuterium story. Again, there are other ways it's a nuisance in the body, but it's also helpful because we do want more deuterium in our blood than we do inside our cells, because there's specific activities when you squeeze deuterium or squash it can make UV light. So it is part of our signaling network, but it has to be in the right place. And again, when it comes to cancer and growth, deuterium is a growth factor. So deuterium and blue light together, just using a thyroid as an example, if I'm sitting here, I have got blocking blue light blocking stuff on. If I'm sitting here shining blue light on my thyroid and I'm eating a high deuterium diet, it's just a recipe for those two together to wreak havoc in that gland. Because it's sort of exposed to the blue light. And simplistically, blue light sort of plays a role in the growth and the taking on board of deuterium, and red light and other parts of the spectrum play a role in getting rid of it. That's why it's much easier to get rid of or deplete your deuterium on the equator. And that's why it's okay to eat pineapples and coconuts, because you and the coconut and the pineapple live together on the equator. The pineapple and the coconut have been programmed with a quantum stamp from the light, but it also has the appropriate amount of deuterium for that environment. So again, it ties back into this idea of not to eat things that don't grow where you live. And then another thing, processed food is absolutely loaded with deuterium. And we all know we shouldn't eat processed food. And some people have an amazing metabolism and they can just burn it off, but you can't per se burn off the deuterium. So there are, you know, thin people who can eat what they want, look good, but they're kind of secretly gathering deuterium over time, and then they're eventually a problem is going to come out. So again, when I'm explaining to people about processed food, once they sort of get the idea that there's this thing in it that's this heavy metal that breaks their mitochondria and it makes them slower in processed food, it kind of by themselves they move away from it a little bit without me having to say, stop eating that, don't eat this, don't eat that, I don't want that in the food diary, why are you eating this? It's about people being able to think, oh, actually I understand now and I'm just gonna not do it anymore.
Yeah, and this idea that you've just described for us of analyzing what we should be eating based on the deuterium content, it's revolutionary. It's very, very unique because most people, I mean, I guess the entry-level approach that most people have been taught to think about it is calories. And, you know, we can talk about how the food industry have influenced and marketed food and nutrition science to try and brainwash people into thinking that, you know, you can drink as much Coke as you want. You can drink a little bit of Coke as long as it's the calories is, you know, fits within your daily allowance. And then the second level, which I think is much more reflective of reality, is the different macronutrients and their effect on our hormonal systems, and particularly with regard to carbohydrates and fats and the different effect they have on insulin and other metabolic hormones. But I guess what we're talking about now is that what you should be eating is dictated by the deuterium content. And why don't you give for the listeners an idea about and you alluded to it a little bit by the fact that you mentioned that deuterium is higher in tropical areas around the equator and in tropical fruits. But what types of foods contain deuterium at what amounts? Give us an idea.
Okay, so just to keep it simple for people, fat's very low, so that even the hated lard is something like 119. So when it comes to levels in the body, if you can have your own personal deuterium levels in the 130s, the chances of cancer or diabetes or obesity are very, very unlikely. But when you start to get into the mid, say, I'd say 140s or definitely over 150, that's when metabolically or health-wise you're in trouble. And again, just before I go into the food, our mitochondria make us nice, lovely, clean, deuterium-depleted water if we put the right fuel in. So the mitochondria have an exhaust, which isn't just the ATP, it's the nice, clean, deuterium-depleted water for all the cells. And, you know, we said the deuterium likes to be in the blood. So when it comes to that aspect, if you put fat in the mitochondria, you get, say, one equivalent of nice water out. If you put protein in, you're going to get about 0.75 equivalents of nice deuterium depleted water. And then if you put carbs in, you get half. So straight away, that's one side of the sort of equation that, okay, I can make my own deuterium depleted water if I eat predominantly fat and protein. Then on the other side, it kind of works out the other way. Again, when you take in protein and fat, assuming it's not collagen, you're not bringing a load of deuterium in as well. So you're less likely to break your ATPase. However, if you start to go into the red box, which is all the food sort of over 147, so that's where you've got grains, sugar. Unfortunately for me, I used to like dark chocolate. That's like 170. Then coffee's really high as well, but then it's the volume of coffee. Nobody's going to eat a bag of coffee beans. Then we've got, you know, all of our things like coconut water, the high deuterium fruit, all the processed foods, all the keto snacks live in there, in the red box with high deuterium. So in a way, if somebody can't compute that, they could just eat fat or protein like a carnivore diet. And that is a very simplistic way to say, okay, just do that. And you're very, very unlikely to overload yourself on deuterium unless you eat far too much. Because again, back to this fast, you know, I like to know lots of things work, but I'd like to know why. So if somebody just calorie restricts or fast, they're just putting less deuterium in, and chances are they're going to be burning some of their own body fat, which is nice and deuterium free. So that's another way to deplete your deuterium. But if you do want to eat, if it's just fat and protein, we've taken away the main deuterium providing foods, and we've put the right ingredients in for our mitochondria to make deuterium depleted water for us. So we've got sort of things, you know, ticking over nicely.
Yeah. And, you know, when I advise my patients on the ideal diet for them, the first rule that I have is eat seasonally and locally. Mm. And the byproduct of that is based on, you know, where I practice in Auburn, New South Wales, in winter, what's available, okay, there's going to be some seasonal vegetables, but, you know, lamb and beef is always available. That's what's walking around in the woods in at that latitude. So it's appropriate then, especially that a carnivore diet or a very low carbohydrate diet is appropriate, particularly at that time of year, for people living at that latitude. And, you know, in the podcast that I did recently with Dr. Jalal Khan, we talked about how, you know, certain health influencers and health nutritional doctors promote an approach that includes fruit and honey, but which is clearly working for them, and they can maintain a good body composition and performance and low amount of ectopic or visceral fat with eating a large amount of tropical fruit and honey. But that's because it's appropriate based on where they live. And if people who live down in a southern latitude eats that amount of food from a different latitude, they're not going to have the same benefits. And the reason that you're saying, Sarah, is that it's because of the deuterium content and the lack of the ability to deplete that deuterium based on the inferior or the reduced amount of solar yield compared to the tropics.
Oh, absolutely. But also with the said person in the said location, they're also going in the ocean every day, and cold therapy is another way to deplete deuterium. So even if anybody with an imagination, or if they're lucky, can get cold in any part of the world to get rid of your deuterium that way. But again, high solar yield on the equator is naturally going to deplete deuterium. And also because it's hotter, they're going to sweat a bit more. So they're going to release a bit more that way. So you're exactly right that eating seasonal and local honey, if you live in Africa or Sri Lanka or Mexico, is different. What I'm really interested in is what happens if somebody like me with an uncoupled haplotype goes and does all of that versus somebody with a coupled haplotype. Because what I find, actually, I've kind of answered my own question. I think even somebody like me with an uncoupled haplotype that's designed to live in Finland, inbuilt in inside me is all the mechanisms to be able to do really well on the equator. So it might be a way for those kind of uncoupled haplotype people to have a superpower in a way if they went on the equator. And I'm not sure because I'm so unaccustomed to eating food like that, I'm not sure whether I would. And I'd just be curious personally to think, what happens if I go to the equator and do everything there from the sun point of view, but then don't eat the tropical fruit? So that's, again, just a sort of discussion amongst ourselves. Do you think it would cause me any hindrance? Because, again, all of this fruit there, and I know that if I try not to eat my own apples in my own garden when they're all out, I get quite, you know, that's why I would say I'm keto, not carnivore, because I do eat things that are from my own garden, because I've tried not eating them, and I actually get more, not stressed, but my ancient physiology really wants those apples. So I'm just curious, maybe you know the answer, what happens if somebody goes and carries on being keto with a very, very uncoupled haplotype, and I'm very cold adapted as well, went onto the equator and stayed keto, so not the same as the person that we know.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting question. And, you know, I've heard people say that they who have been strict carnivore, they went to Bali for a holiday with the tropical fruits around and obviously the humidity and the temperature. And it sounded very similar to what you described, Sarah. It was visceral and quite physical discomfort at the idea of not consuming what is obviously locally grown banana or locally grown mango. I'm fascinated by that idea of having the inbuilt machinery to deal with those equatorial conditions, and that makes sense from the point of view that we came out of Africa, and our ancestors, so-called mitochondrial Eve, was an African woman, you could say, that yeah. was the the origin of our species. So it, to me, it makes sense that it could be inducible, but I'm not exactly sure on the details. In terms of the haplotype, just explain briefly for the listener, because that can be quite technical. What is the difference between a coupled and an uncoupled haplotype, and why is that relevant for deuterium depletion and everything that we've just talked about?
Okay, so briefly, without getting into the letters, the haplotype you're describing is an L, and the haplotype I was describing for me, I'm a T. So basically, with a coupled haplotype, you're designed to be able to run away from lions very, very quickly, but you're very energy efficient with your food. Whereas somebody like me with an uncoupled haplotype, I need to take in more food. I waste some of it dissipating heat, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. But also there's much more to these haplotypes that because they've evolved over a significant amount of time, it's like SNPs or SNPs. There are certain disadvantages and advantages of having a coupled and uncoupled haplotype. I don't know enough about it yet because actually that's something I'm studying, all of the different traits and pros and cons, but just to keep it sort of simple, the uncoupled haplotypes do fine in the cold, and the coupled haplotypes are more of a warm temperate climate person, so they don't like cold therapy, but they still get the benefits of it. They would just do it at sort of a significantly higher degree than me, but it's not that a coupled or an uncoupled haplotype's better. It's all about what you do, where you live with that haplotype. And what my question, again, back to you is, I, with an uncoupled haplotype, will perfectly happily live on the equator. But if I plucked somebody with a coupled haplotype that's very geared for their particular location with heat, the days are the same length all the time there, and brought them and plonked them in the UK, that particular haplotype plus this weather, being away from the equator, having to deal with the cold, a different way of eating is not going to be favourable. But just so people know, it's not better to have one haplotype or the other, but it does quite strongly dictate where your ideal environment or neighbourhood is to live. And also, yes, it does dictate, yes, your way of eating, that an uncoupled haplotype is going to be, it's more preferable to eat a ketogenic diet, whereas the coupled one would have evolved on the equator with the pineapples and the mangoes anyway. So that I from my current studies, and I'm not going to like go into detail, it would look like the uncoupled haplotypes are less good at dealing with carbohydrates naturally. But I don't know what happens if you put them on the equator. That's why I was asking you this question.
Yeah, no, and for the listener, the way I think about it is, when we evolved, the coupled haplotypes evolved on the equator, you know, in Africa, with a massive amount of solar exposure. So if you think about African people, they are rich in melanin in their skin, and that is one of the tools that they can use to actually harvest energy from the sun. So that played an immense role in helping them survive and thrive in that particular area. But as we pushed north, as we migrated, Homo sapiens migrated in tribal bands north of Africa and into Europe, where the temperature was colder, the UV light exposure was less, then we evolved, our mitochondria evolved this uncoupled haplotype, which, as we talked about earlier about brown fat, and it's related, is that we were able to basically use that electron transport chain to generate heat. And the reason why that would have been beneficial is because we had to maintain a body temperature. We have to maintain our body temperature at a very set temperature, and without that we would have died. So you can see how there was an evolutionary pressure to be able to maintain a body temperature, and that is the uncoupled haplotype that Sarah and I are just discussing. I would suspect that someone who, say an African or a coupled haplotype who gets plonked up in northern Finland, would have a much more difficult way of surviving and getting by and thriving compared to a transplantee with of northern European descent in the equator, based on the fact that they have an immense amount of sun requirements in the way that And it was basically a unidirectional evolutionary adaptation. So the person from the equator hasn't yet made those adaptions, but the person who came from Africa ancestrally and then lived in Northern Europe has kind of got the toolkit deep in their genome. So I mean, that's just my speculation, but I guess to make the point is that we have to respect our ancestry when it comes to our diet and the exposures, like cold exposure, like sun exposure, in terms of health optimization, depleting deuterium and making our mitochondria work as well as possible.
Yes, and actually you just reminded me of something about folate and UV light, that fairer skinned people, this is not in any way, oh, sun is bad. It's just UV light does deplete our folate, but that's the whole reason why we're supposed to build a tan. And you can do that whether you're a Fitzpatrick one. So I think back to my own question, 100% you respect your environment and the sun. And again, it's back to, even if you are from Finland or from Iceland and your skin's very pale, there's still going to be the ability to build a solar callus. But I think, you know, again, if they had to be transported to the equator, I would just think, be careful of your folate, but not to be afraid of the sun, because that's not what I'm saying at all. What happens is, when you don't have loads of melanin, that they don't have loads of UVA anyway, or B, so they don't need the protection, because that's the whole point of melanin. Again, when people on the equator have loads of melanin and very dark skin, to protect their folate as well. And again, you know, you eat folate from things which are in your environment. And I think, again, if somebody from Finland was to move to Africa, they would need to eat the food that was there, because it's providing not just deuterium it provides other important nutrients and information that are geared for living in that place.
Yeah, and it's a good opportunity to talk about appropriate sun exposure. And if someone does have a Fitzpatrick 1 skin type or a very fair skin type, then the amount of UVB radiation that they can take before sunburning is going to be a lot less than someone with a very dark skin type. So I think the messages, and especially in my country, Sarah, where, you know, the sun is up there next to I don't know what, in terms of causes of all human misery, but it's the messages is very, very anti-sun. But what I'm saying, what you're saying, is that it's not about avoiding the sun, but it's the opposite. Instead, we need to be very carefully and conscientiously and intentionally exposing our skin to the sun and our eyes to the sun at the right time, and basically titrate our exposure based on our Fitzpatrick skin type. And the fairer we are, the less time we'd need before walking into the shade, sitting under a tree, if we have a fairer skin type. And so I just wanted to make that point.
The thing is, I'm half a New Zealander, so I'm fully aware of what goes on in New Zealand and Australia, because unfortunately you've got the hole in the ozone layer. And because I'm a bit of a nerd, I always measure UVI indexes wherever I go. So it is pretty massive in New Zealand and Australia. And 100% I agree, there's just slap on the sunscreen. But also the Maoris and the Aborigines are completely different to, our ancestors who are visitors, so they're not really supposed to be living there anyway. And not to bother, I don't know about New Zealand, but I know that the water in Australia, it is pretty heavy in deuterium. So on one hand, the northern part is pretty much equatorial. You've got enough sun to get rid of your deuterium. But then your government is very much, and it's the same in New Zealand. Don't go out there. It's dangerous. There's a massive hole in the ozone layer. You'll burn. And then there's a huge, I know that hasn't Australia and New Zealand got the highest rate of skin cancers? But that brings me back to other points. Like, how do you know that people weren't just sitting in the blue light inside for ages, eating a lot of deuterium rich food, and that was just basically loading the gun? And then they decided, I'll just go outside and burn, and that pulled the trigger. So then that gets the sun gets the blame, even though the blue light and the deuterium were in the background brewing this for years. And I think this is back to what you were saying about the sensitive sun, the sun exposure as well. And also, again, the seed oils, that if we've got loads of PUFAs in our subcutaneous fat and skin, we're much more prone to burning.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Sarah, because essentially we've got this causal claim, and let's parse it out for the listeners. We have got this claim that's been pushed by health authorities that, you know, sun exposure and UV light causes skin cancer. And as you said, in the background, we've got all these potential confounders to that relationship, which, as you mentioned, processed foods, seed oils that are not only rich in deuterium, but they have a bunch of linoleic acid breakdown products like 4-HNE and linoleic acid itself that's being incorporated into the skin cells, into the keratinocytes, that are going to predispose them or increase their predisposition to inflammation when UV light hits them. So you've got not only got the processed food, you're blocking the endogenous defense mechanisms with sunglasses and sunscreens, because you're preventing the body from building a hormetic response to UV light exposure if you're constantly slathering sunscreen on. And then the predominant light environment that people are exposed to these days isn't sunlight, it's artificial light. And I think that's been lost in terms of the reality of what most people are living in. Most people are under artificial light. In the car, they've got the windows up. So again, it's not a natural light spectrum. At home, they're under LED down lights. At every point, it's not like they're getting natural sunlight throughout the day. So we've got all these confounders in the path of this causal connection between sunlight and skin cancers. And then if you look at the epidemiology of this condition, both melanoma and non-melanoma skin cancers, it's gone, and particularly melanoma skin cancers, it's gone up despite the imposition of these public health measures, and people are getting less outdoor sun exposure. So, I mean, we have to really be thinking, we have to think a little bit deeper than simply, okay, sun causes cancer, skin cancer.
Exactly. There's another layer to this, the vitamin D, because everybody agrees that low vitamin D is a big risk for all cancers and many other diseases. Therefore, people in the know have decided, we'll just supplement everybody with vitamin D. But that's not the same. It's basically, without going into lots of detail, it disturbs all the intermediates on the way to making vitamin D, and it can actually cause your body to, if you can make it, don't take it. So you stop being able to make your own sulfated vitamin D. So they're actually making the problem worse by supplementing. Yet it's glaringly obvious if somebody's got low vitamin D, they're inside all the time. Because I think a lot of the time when I look at people's vitamin D and it's natural without them taking supplements, it's just an indirect measure of, to some extent, how much time people are spending inside versus outside. Because again, too much blue light and EMFs, even if you're in a good area for UVB, if you're bathing in blue light and EMF, it can inhibit your own natural production to some extent. So I think, again, the vitamin D is a really important part of this, as I would say, cancer lie.
Totally. I can put in the show notes some papers that show the repeated association of melanoma with low vitamin D. So if UV is the problem, and UVB generates endogenous vitamin D, why are people who are developing melanoma almost invariably vitamin D deficient? So again, it's an invitation to think a little bit more deeply about the whole problem. The point I want to go back to and really expand upon is this relationship of artificial light and metabolic disease and diabetes. And you tied it into deuterium by mentioning that if we're constantly having if our bodies are deuterium loaded, then we're going to more likely to develop metabolic cancer and diabetes. And as far as I'm concerned, they are metabolic diseases. They are diseases of mitochondria. And we look at how cancer cells behave. They invariably have broken mitochondria. They're bioenergetic. It's a bioenergetic problem. And if we, Dr. Doug Wallace wrote a paper, the mitochondrial bioenergetic model of disease, which basically lays out how all these modern neurodegenerative cancers, metabolic diseases are a function of or a product of defective mitochondria. So what we're saying, or what you made the point, Sarah, is that exposure to artificial light is provoking people's metabolic dysfunction. So talk a little bit more about why that might be the case and why it's not only a food story.
Okay, just to add on about the changes in mitochondrial morphology, when they look at the mitochondria of type 2 diabetics, they're morphologically different and they're smaller in a bad way. So again, that's more than just a food story. Well, first of all, with the diabetes, if we just start with, say, the non-native EMFs, and just to keep it simple for the listeners, our bodies and our genetics and our biochemistry has evolved over millions of years to communicate with only the terrestrial sunlight. So we're geared to work within a given range, which is the UV range, and then all the way up into the infrared. We haven't got the appropriate kind of biochemistry yet, and maybe humans will evolve to deal properly with other waves, which would be Wi-Fi, radio waves, microwaves, and stuff like that. So that invisible light is fundamentally going to provide a confusing signal to our mitochondria, because humans are a sort of giant amplifier that light can land on us, even a small amount, and that signal can get propagated through, and then the mitochondria get the message about our environment, the seasons. Whereas if we're giving the mitochondria this really strange sort of light, the Wi-Fi, the non-native EMFs, the microwaves, is going to create chaos. And chaos, like from a biophysical word, is just our way of describing inflammation. And again, inflammation can be synonymous to mitochondrial dysfunction. It's just going to cause systemic disease. And things like diabetes and cancer are a systemic sort of condition in the body. And there wasn't any mention of anything to do with food there. We were just talking about technology. Did you want to talk about POMC and the blue light? And because I just say it to people, it's almost like getting a sugar rush without getting the pleasure of the food.
Mm. Yeah, sure. Well, definitely. Let's talk. Let's go.
Yes, because I think, again, Jalal covered it extremely elegantly in the podcast, and I highly recommend listening to that episode. It was superb. But just again, to come back to this idea of the sun gives off slightly different sort of colours or wavelengths of light throughout the day, and we've got this molecule in us called POMC, and depending on what colour light it receives, it'll be chopped up into different peptides that do things in the body. So we've got alpha MSH, which can regulate appetite, say that's and melanin production. Then we've got ACTH, which can increase cortisol secretion. So that's going to push the blood sugar up. And then there's CLIP, which is something that's an insulin secretagog. So that means insulin's going to go up. So we've effectively created a scenario using blue light, because when we're exposed to just blue light without the other wavelengths, to keep things simple, POMC gets cut up in a way where we've got lots of ACTH, lots of CLIP, so we've got a lot of cortisol, a lot of insulin. So it's the same scenario. We're going to have, like, our blood sugar will go up as eating something, and then our body has to then draw that sugar in. And insulin, in simple words, is sort of a growth and storage hormone. Obviously, it's important. So I know it's how we survived when we lived underground and couldn't access the sun. But unfortunately, that thing which is part of our why we're here today, I think is going to be part of why the human race could. Well, I feel in some ways the human race really is under threat. I'm not sure if you feel the same.
Yeah, no. I mean, we've engineered an environment for ourselves in this day and age that is in stark opposition to or incompatible with our evolved biology. And I think that's the crux of why so many people are sick and so many people are unwell, is because individually we're not respecting, or collectively we're not respecting our biology and what we need, our evolutionarily needs. The implications of what you just said are that if you are constantly exposed to blue light, then you are going to make your pre-diabetes, your fatty liver, your diabetes, your obesity, your PCOS, that's all going to get worse. And there are studies that show, I mean, there's studies showing that exposure to blue light raises triglycerides. You know, I've heard anecdotally from type 1 diabetics that simply wearing blue light blocking glasses, their insulin requirements went down. So their body needed less insulin because they were under less blue light. And do you think, Sarah, is it predominantly the effect of cortisol kind of causing gluconeogenesis or liberating stored fat in terms of raising the blood glucose level?
Oh no, that's a really good question. It has to depend on the context. That's something that's my next experiment, is to wear CGM because I measure my labs and things a lot, and people like to do experiments and wear things, because it's a really good question you've asked, because I want to see how much does it raise the blood sugar or the cortisol when I don't eat anything. Because the problem there is the act of fasting, the cortisol does go up a little bit anyway. So I need to make sure which is me not eating and which is the blue light. So I'm probably going to approach it a slightly different way, to eat exactly the same thing with the CGM on and weigh it out carefully at the same time of the day under different light environments. Because I think flipping it around and looking at it that way, because sometimes the problem is that we eat something and we don't have very good insulin sensitivity. So the body produces a great big mountain of it, which then takes ages to go away. So what I'm saying is, if you eat the same thing in a different light environment, you're going to produce less insulin because you're more sensitive. And the less insulin you produce over time, you're going to become more insulin sensitive and less insulin resistant. And I don't know. I mean, yes, there's going to be a pathway linked to the dopamine usage and depletion because of blue light. Because again, I mean, I'm really interested in thyroid glands, but I have noticed over the years with myself and people, if you've got good dopamine, that seems to trump bad thyroid. So there's fundamentally an energy production based on dopamine. And again, being a catecholamine is going to tie into sort of being able to raise blood sugar similar to epinephrine. And I don't even know whether they're involved in that either. So I don't know the exact answer that you wanted about, is it just cortisol? I think it's a combination of the cortisol and having more insulin for absolutely no reason at all than you need, whether you're going to eat or not. So again, I'd be really interested in your thoughts on this, because I think it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah, and look, I didn't know a thing about POMC as it related to metabolic diseases until I talked to Dr. Jack Cruz, and he explained that his theory, and it seems to be quite backed up by what I've been reading, is that we evolved this facility or this function, you know, when we were cave dwelling mammals, it's a vestigial kind of function that our bodies have, and then since we invented these blue lights, it's almost hijacked this pathway, but not in a good way, but actually in a bad way. I really want to pick up on the implication of what you just said just before, which is that our light environment is influencing our insulin sensitivity, and this is relevant for people who have diabetes and metabolic disease and obesity, because it means that if we're optimizing our light environment, which is allowing ourselves to be regulated throughout the day by the natural wavelengths of sunlight, and avoiding artificial light at night and avoiding exposure to non-native EMF, then we can potentially have a diet that is richer in local carbohydrates and still remain insulin sensitive, which is what, you know, Dr. Paul Saldino has learned himself, but has not yet realized, I think. So, I mean, that's the fascinating implication. And that is why Dr. Cruz said to me that, you know, your first advice to reverse someone's metabolic disease should be correcting their light environment, which, you know, is a big head exploding moment for us who have trained in more low carb and metabolic type medicine, where, you know, the diet is the first kind of lever that we pull traditionally.
Oh no, that's really important. I think it loops back to what I said at the beginning. If something is made too difficult or strict to a patient or a person, they won't do it at all. So it's better to have a multi-pronged approach. I completely agree. It's more than just a food story, but I think it's also easier, even if it makes a person's head explode on a biophysical level, it's actually much easier on an emotional level to change your light environment. Because as you know, if you mention food on the internet, the whole roof blows off and people get massively offended and wars happen. Whereas people tend to be just, they're not attached to their blue light. They just don't understand. Yes, they're attached to their phones, but that's a whole other issue. But that's one item. Yes, it's a pretty bad one for non-native EMFs. But I think also, like I was saying at the beginning, if you take people by surprise and tell your patient who's overweight to change their light environment, they'll be like, oh, well, he didn't tell me to eat less and move more. I'm surprised. I'm curious. And that's, again, this idea. When people get surprised or curious or there's a different emotion, they're much more open to suggestions. This is, again, a sort of hypnosis idea. And automatically that your patient's opened up to you or me because I haven't treaded on something sensitive, which is their weight or their diet. And like I said before, sometimes people just change their diet by themselves. They don't have to tell them. They discover Dr. Cruz for themselves because I open the door for them, and then they go down it, and then they start off, you know, in the earlier days when he was much more amenable to just eating fat and protein, and they just do it by themselves. And that's even better because nobody told them to do it. Whereas if we tell them to do it, it's always, oh yes, but you told me to, kind of thing. So I'm actually kind of curious about your patient's reaction to when you suggest a light environment as opposed to a medication or a way of eating. Because obviously the patients want the medication, you know, that's the easiest one. They want that one, you would think. But then the light one, I think, is easy.
Yeah, and to clarify, I mean, I'm advising for both. And before I answer the question, I'll make another observation, is that the people that I've seen who have type 2 diabetes, pre-diabetes, all the manifestations of metabolic dysfunction, insulin resistance, every single one of them to me is basically sunlight deficient, in that they're not getting the sunlight exposure or the circadian regulation that they're particularly that they need. And that's, the darker they are, you know, at the lower latitudes, you know, it seems like the more likely they are to kind of manifest this. And I think, you know, people in the subcontinental origin, that they're very much prone to developing diabetes and putting down visceral fat. And I think that a contributing factor there is the fact that they're not getting the solid yield that their biology requires. But so that's just been an anecdotal observation for me, is that in addition to eating carbs and eating seed oils, that these people and these patients are also deficient in terms of their sunlight needs. But when I approach the problem, I'm not only talking about light, because if we think about someone who's really sick with type 2 diabetes and they're on supplemental insulin, you know, the intervention that's going to move the needle is going to be cutting down that carbohydrate level. You're not going to halve, you know, 50 units of insulin. That's not going halved simply because of light, especially if you're at a low latitude where there isn't a massive amount of solar yield to play with. So I think, obviously we're still, the food is important. That's why my message to patients is always mind your food diet and mind your light diet. But and obviously they're complementary. And if we do all of them, like we eat mostly fat and protein or carnivore type approach, and we get into the sun or we get cold, then you know that is where the visceral fat just evaporates. And you know people get better from a metabolic point of view very quickly.
Oh no, I completely agree. Because also, in order to be insulin resistant, they need to be leptin resistant as well. And leptin is definitely my favorite, or one of my favorite hormones. And that's got a strong circadian component because it's hugely tied into the central retinal pathway. But it's also right under the skin, so in the fat cells. So it's going to be able to be communicated with via light. But also there's the food aspect to leptin, because I've played around with doing the light part perfectly and then eating wrong, and some, you know, unfavorable things happen, but then it works the same the other way. But when it comes to doing unfavorable things with the food, I'm talking about not just eating just fat and protein, eating too often, because I believe there are leptin receptors in the tongue. So that sometimes can be an approach for people I work with. Okay, why not, let's change from 5 meals a day to 3, and let's have them only when the sun's up. And again, that's a step in the right direction. So I'm getting what I want. I want them to eat less, but I'm not going to say it openly. But then I'm also making sure a significant aspect of the circadian clock is honored, that they're eating 3 times a day, not too often. They get up, have breakfast, see the sunrise, and then they have their last meal before sunset. So I'm not creating an insulin surge in the evening, which is going to completely disrupt leptin's message. And then that also ties back into what you say, that exactly, I don't think people nowadays, even if maybe even not on the equator, can get, I know there's the experiments with the Maasai eating cakes and Mars bars and stuff, but for everybody, I think, you know, you can't get away with having the perfect light environment and eating Twinkies and McDonald's all the time. You know, it's the whole food story does matter as well. Because I've tried it out, and if I, because I'm pretty good with my circadian rhythm, because it's really important. Whereas if I disobey the leptin eating rules, that then I gain weight, even though my light environment. I mean, people would say, "Oh, yes, but you live in the UK and it's a shithole and all of that." But it's not really. My point of my argument is, I can do the best I can with what I've got and my cold therapy and manage everything. But then if I do start eating when I shouldn't, or eating too often, or eating after dark, it doesn't work. And I think that's another big issue that people have, is being given permission to eat all the time, or to cuddle up on the sofa and watch a movie and have a takeaway. I think that's kind of another very terrible sort of circadian problem that there is. I'm not sure what your experience is with your patients, but I've found if I really can't get them to do anything with the food, it's like, right, okay, I don't care what you do in the day, just stop eating at sunset and let's do this for 3 weeks.
Yeah, no, I love it. And look, this is one way of thinking about it, is what we're eating, which is what is the macronutrient composition or the deuterium composition of the food, then the next order is, when are we eating it? How frequently are we eating? What is the meal timing? And then maybe the third order is, what is the light environment that we're eating our food in? But you can see how multifaceted and multidimensional this whole idea of diet is. And so much of the narrative and the argumentation online and elsewhere is, you know, is caught up in debating what exactly we should be eating, you know, on a calorie point of view, or all this kind of, you know, it's really stuck in a quagmire when we can see how important the timing of meals is from a circadian point of view, and the deuterium, which we mentioned earlier. And I want to make the point that from a physiological point of view, it's not only your brain that has the clock that controls our circadian rhythm. And for those who have started to look into circadian biology, there's a region of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the master coordinator of your body's physiological circadian processes. But there's also clocks in your liver, in your gut, in your pancreas, in your adipose tissue. So eating at the wrong time, which is, you know, after sunset, eating a big meal after sunset is going to cause its own little type of circadian disruption, and it's going to cause that incongruent or a confusing message to your body. So I agree with you completely, Sarah, and I think that if we can reduce the frequency of meal consumption, even if we're only slightly increasing the fat and protein, but we're reducing the frequency of meal consumption and we're making that meal consumption during the day rather than at night, then that people can see definitely improvements for sure.
Yeah, because definitely Dr. Sachin Panda nailed all of that. I think he's writing another book. He didn't go enough into light, because the other aspect about all of this is when it's all about, well, why does somebody want to carry on eating chips and burgers and biscuits? Because something, when you correct your circadian rhythm and you reset your leptin, it also controls your appetite and your desire for these kind of foods. And people think they can't live without them, but when they actually correct their circadian rhythm, see, say, the UVA rise and make plenty of dopamine and endocannabinoids and MSH, and then we've got enkephalins and endorphins, they get high on their own supply and they don't actually want to eat all of these things anymore. So, and also when your leptin's working properly, your body knows exactly how much energy there is on board, and it's going to regulate your appetite accordingly. If you've got rid of the desire for this food, because I know binge eating is a massive problem for a lot of people, then straight away two boxes are ticked. You don't want it anymore and you're not hungry. And all that was all fixed by fixing leptin. Then if you get off your phone a bit, you're not going to be constantly depleting your dopamine and your body demanding chocolate or biscuits to pop the dope, or worse, to pop the dopamine back up. So that kind of ties into how fixing your circadian biology can be really helpful for addictions, especially those which revolve around dopamine, which is all, pretty much all of them in their own way. So I think there's a lot of this thing. I'm very much about, even if you think this is stupid, why don't you just try it?
Yeah. And look, I love how you brought that point up, because it answers this really critical fundamental point about overeating, the processed food and weight gain, and explains why people are so addicted to processed foods is because their circadian signaling is dysfunctional, and because they've developed leptin resistance, their body doesn't know how much energy is on board. So, and I think this is a point that the low carb doctors on their own, or the low carb movement, is missing, is that why are people so hyperphagic? Why are people craving processed food? And what came first? And the answer to that is that, you know, the processed foods are inherently addictive, which they are, and yeah. I agree completely. But what you and I are saying, Sarah, is that the disruption of the circadian rhythm, the fact that we haven't stimulated POMC enough with UV light and natural sunlight exposure, that is, and become leptin resistant, that is the signal that's driving overeating, that's driving food cravings, that's driving the consumption or the desire to eat these processed foods. And then they obviously feed back on each other. And obviously there's linoleic acid breakdown products like 4-HNE that also bind to the endocannabinoid system. And I talked to Tucker Goodrich about that. But those are inherent in the food. But what we're saying is there's signals inherent in our environment that is also driving the overeating. So I really see it as the genesis of the problem. The genesis of the problem of metabolic disease and obesity lies in that circadian disruption and lies in our artificial light environment, because of the reasons that I just mentioned and everything that we've talked about. So I love it how, and tying back to the beginning of the conversation, is why you address circadian disruption first is because it's like the keystone, or the, you know, the angel at the top of the Christmas tree. It's like it's the thing that once we sort that out, everything else will find a way of sorting itself out.
Yeah, I usually say it's like killing the chief vampire in Lost Boys. If you get rid of the chief vampire, all the others will go. But also there's another fundamentally really important point I want to bring up is the fact that only 30% of the electrons we get are food electrons. So food only accounts for 30% of our actual sort of energy, you know, intake as a human being. And again, for people who are completely brand new to this, we can get energy from the sun. I mentioned earlier us being a solar panel because the photons can excite are the electrons in us, and that's again a means of gaining energy. But also we can use magnetism, because we didn't really talk about that, and by grounding, and that's again another way we're disconnected from nature. By wearing rubber-soled shoes and being inside all the time, we're not connected to nature anymore in a grounding way, but also from an energetic point of view. That I think you brought it up in one another podcast, that when, you know, we're outside all day or at the beach, it's really sunny, or we're lying on the grass, we just don't seem to feel hungry because we've satisfied our electron need from nature, and therefore the desire for food electrons isn't there anymore. So there's that aspect as well for sort of looking at quantum biology sort of globally, because we've talked a lot about light and magnetism's not really been mentioned, which is fine. And then we've touched on water a bit. So it's sort of tying it all together. That, and you mentioned melanin again as like, I think that's our seventh energy system, because we've got more energy systems in our body than we think. It's not just ATP and the structured water or the electrons, that there's more. So that's the other thing, that people are fixated on this idea. The only way we can get energy is by eating.
Yeah, and maybe that would be the last topic that we talk about, so we don't overload people with information. But yeah. I really wanted you to talk about this idea of a health optimization strategy as an electron gathering exercise. And this sounds very bizarre and esoteric to most people. How can health be related to gathering electrons, and what does that even mean? Could you explain and expand a bit more about electrons as energy and why or how we gather them other than food?
Okay, well, just sort of in a simple way to start off with, is like electrons are like money for the cell, or like charge. So the more electrons we've got more charge. And anybody that's used a torch, it doesn't work very well when the batteries are nearly flat. So that's what somebody with sort of like a low redox or a low level of electrons. But the other really important factor is that the more electrons we've got in our body, like I said, only sunlight can excite the electrons. So the more electrons we've got to start with, the more benefit we're going to get from the sun. But then that means the more energy that we can have, so the more powerful we can become. So that's one aspect of it, would be grounding, because we can draw electrons in because planet Earth is negatively charged. The other way to view it is not necessarily just gathering electrons, but how do I stop them being stolen? Because alcohol is an oxidizing agent, so in chemistry terms, it steals electrons. And also, unfortunately, as much as people love their tech, that's an electron stealer as well. So that's going to affect how many electrons you've got. The way that the tech spoils it all is it makes the exclusion zone smaller, and that's fundamentally how we've got our sort of water network, how the electrons actually get round the body and sort of our energy system. I'm not going to go into proton wires now because it might be a bit too much. So again, thinking about how can we not lose electrons is really important, as well as how can we gather them in. So obviously grounding, and that doesn't necessarily mean standing on the grass. You can touch a plant that's planted. You can sit on a metal bench, assuming it's sort of not connected to some kind of unpleasant electrical network. You can stand in a puddle. You can walk on the beach. You can get into the sea. You can swim in a lake. And all of these are going to be electron gathering activities. And the more you do it, there are lots of studies on grounding, you know, that there are benefits to doing it for over half an hour on blood flow and inflammation and stuff like that. So there is this fundamental idea with inflammation. If you've got too many protons or H pluses and not enough electrons, you're going to have inflammation. So if you think about gathering in as many electrons as possible, and don't let things steal them, or don't take things that are going to steal them, that's a sort of way to sort of approach life in a sort of simplistic way, but also it's actually very accurate biophysically as well. And again, lots of people avoid talking about physics because they think it's complicated, but it isn't really when you get into it, and it actually makes things have a lot of sense. Because I just think about things in terms of protons and electrons and what are they doing, and it's really helped me understand a lot of things I didn't about biochemistry or supplements or keto diets. But then I can also explain it to patients as well. And also, if somebody wants to get into a debate, it's very hard to disagree with the fundamental laws of physics, whereas I can pull apart pretty much any randomized control trial in 5 minutes. I mean, yes, we have our studies that we quote, but fundamentally, when we read them, there is always something wrong with them. And I'm not being horrible to the authors, it's just there's always something wrong with them somewhere. Whereas the laws of physics, as the, you know, that's very difficult to disagree with.
Yes, it is, isn't it? And look, the way I think about it, and I am not by any means an expert on the biophysical body per se, and it's something that I'm learning more about myself. But essentially, we are electrical beings, and we all animals. Have an electric charge, and the process, and when we respect that reality and see ourselves as almost like a battery, then you know, charging yourself up by plugging yourself into the earth makes sense, as well as, you know, getting sunlight and avoiding, you know, potentially things that discharge you, like non-native EMF sources, like technology and Wi-Fi, 5G, these types of things. That's a very in-depth question, topic and podcast we've just recorded, Sarah. And did you have anything that you wanted to mention in closing that we might have mentioned or not mentioned?
I think always people, I always try and give people practical advice, because no matter what, people want to eat cakes and play on the computer and drink wine. And I'm not saying don't do it, but can you just go and do it outside? And it'll, that's what I always say, because if you take away everybody's treats, then, you know, we have to have some joy, you know. So just go and do it outside. That's what I do with my phone. If I'm gonna do something, even if it's working or editing a video or whatever, I'll go outside and do it and sit grounded, even if I'm cold. It's tough, you know. And then for people who want to eat and drink things that they enjoy, do it outside.
Yeah, that's a great piece of advice. And I was just outside before on my computer, and the amount of blue light that's being emitted from your laptop screen relative to the sun is so negligible. So the best case scenario is setting up your outdoor workspace outside. If you can get your feet on the ground or on some grass, that's great. And again, to emphasize the point that we made about diet, I still think a low carb or ketogenic for most people is a default great diet. And with the addition of seasonal fruit, if you don't have pre-existing metabolic disease, which is, you know, 88% of Americans, Sarah. It's difficult to add this nuance because people want the simple answer, but I think, you know, eating locally and seasonally kind of is really the most simple distillation of both your deuterium advice and kind of what I'm saying with regard to diet.
Oh no, I agree. But I still think that people have to think it's a work in progress, because even though I've trained in ketogenic diets and I've done it like before by myself for over a decade, I still did loads of things wrong and ate the wrong food at the wrong time. And it's all a massive work in progress, and you can't get it perfect the first time. And even if somebody, like we said, just eats three meals instead of four, that's a really good start. But I always, you know, I always think no matter what, you can always do better, but you don't have to do it this moment. But it would be nice if you could not to eat so many pears, please, even though they're local and seasonal, because you don't need 10 pears, because there are things like that as well. But also to always, you know, to always think, because as I get older, I always think, okay, well, what am I deficient in, and what can I do to offset my aging? So the thing that I've got left now is to get fully into the full deep CT, because I've only done sort of down to 55 degrees,
and I've never gone thermogenesis.
Yes, the cold thermogenesis, and I've never been to the equator. So when I talked to Dr. Cruz, that was the one thing he said, oh, well done, you're doing really well with the cold. Well, I've known about that for about 8 years, but I've never actually gone on the equator and lived there for a bit to see what happens. So I think that's the other thing for people is to, you know, not to berate yourself, but to always think, okay, I'm going to be getting older. What can I do to kind of constantly delay the process? And I think what I'm trying to say is some people try and just do everything perfectly straight away and they can't do it. And they think, oh, this is rubbish, or they binge eat. And then other people say, oh, well, you know, I've done what you said. I've eaten three meals, not four. And I'm like, yeah, but that's just one thing. We've got like a whole journey to go on as well. And also different things move the needle in different people. Sometimes food, like just taking out something that's got histamines in it, can be a massive game changer for a person. For somebody else, seeing never missing a sunrise, another person, it can be just buying blue blockers. But I always think you need to try all of these needle changes. Same with ways of eating. I'm very much, well, don't slag it off, just do it. I've done vegan, I've done raw keto vegan, I've done carnivore, I've done fasting, I've done like 3-to-1 almost epilepsy keto diets, because it's like you don't know what you don't know, and always be open-minded and always try something. And like you're saying, just because something works for one person in Costa Rica, it doesn't mean it's going to work for you. And not to give up either, because there are so many different variations. And like you said, we have gone quite detailed, but I've tried not to go into super geek mode. And there's always nuances, but you have to sort of make those first steps and changes.
Definitely. So use yourself as an experiment, try everything out. If you're medicated, yeah, see a doctor. don't necessarily do it all yourself. And yet see someone who has some understanding of these different approaches, because like you said, Sarah, we don't want people to give up because they tried one thing that didn't work for them.
And also there's so many different flavors of carnivore. I mean, you can have carnivore that doesn't have dairy in it. You can have a carnivore with fish, because we haven't even gone into DHA, because that's another one of my favorite topics, but it's too late now. And you can have keto that's got fruit in it and pears and even keto desserts. And you can make, there are ways to make, you know, low deuterium things. I think once you understand the fundamentals and it works. And I think also sometimes people don't mind what they're eating as long as they're getting a result. And that can be really important as well. That if you're not getting the result that you expected from doing this way of eating, it might be worth asking somebody to just have a quick look at it, and also to look at your light environment as well. Because sometimes it really, it isn't the food, and sometimes it actually genuinely is the food.
Is the food, yeah. Mm. And look, I favor a kind of raw seafood carnivore myself when I'm living at low latitudes. That seems to work the best for me. But yeah, everyone's going to be slightly different. And talking to someone who has some understanding of these different approaches, I think is going to be the key for people. So so thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you for your very, very interesting hour and a half discussion. And maybe we'll have to have another chat sometime about DHA and maybe melanopsin and a whole bunch of other stuff that we haven't talked about.
Irisin. Yes, there's all sorts of glorious things we can go into.
Great. Well, you actually win the prize for the coolest pair of blue blockers that anyone's worn on my show. So congratulations for that.
Yeah, these are the original Dave Asprey True Dark yellow glasses. And I have to say they are pretty good. I've still got the red ones, you know, the full wraparounds, and they're absolutely superb if you're a bad sleeper. The red ones that are literally glue themselves to your face are brilliant. Amazing. Yeah, I'm glad I've won the prize of the best blue blockers.
And where can people find you? Where can they like listen to your content and maybe even consult with you if they're interested?
All right. I go by Busy Superhuman on TikTok, YouTube and Instagram. And I've got different posts and content on different channels, long form, short form and pictures. And then, yes, I do consultations, but I'm currently now doing an affordable monthly group membership. So that's for anybody who wants to learn about quantum biology, have their ways of eating troubleshooted, help with what's a quantum day, people that just want to try and understand Dr. Cruz or all sorts of things. And it's the kind of place, if you don't like it and it's not for you, it's only a month and you're not locked into anything for a long time. And that's where you can, find me.
Amazing. We'll include that in the show notes so people can get in touch. So thanks again, Sarah. Have a great night.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Max. It's been absolutely superb talking to you. I love the way you decode everything into simple language for the listeners. I think that was the best part of all your Dr. Cruz podcast was your Cruz whispering, basically.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. I try and make it understandable. So, yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening to the Regenerative Health Podcast. I hope this episode helped you better understand some aspect of improving your lifestyle for optimal health. If you enjoyed this episode, then share it out with friends and family. Leaving a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify podcasts also helps spread the message. Thank you and see you next time.